Good morning. So we are all feeling a bit under the weather these days at the monastery. I think more than half of us are down. Some are still standing. But we are taking every precaution. So I don't know whether I'm carrying the bug with me, which is why I'll always wear a mask when I talk to you. It is not because you smell. It's just to make sure that if I'm a carrier, I don't pass anything on to you. I'm only here to pass one thing. Nothing more than that. But so far I'm okay. By God's grace, shall we say? God is what? Give or deny. Yes. If you have given good health, then you shall be the recipient of that. If you have spread illness, and illness comes in many shapes and forms, doesn't always have to be physical. Actually, I'll tell you one little bit of an anecdote before we get started. Don't worry, I'll remember to precept you. Just something that came up in a conversation I had recently with an Anagarika Puta at the monastery. So when I was just walking in the, we call it the Dayaka Parishri or the Dayaka devotee area. So I saw this, what do you call those things that you take off a plaster before you stick it on? That thing. It's called a thingamabob, that one. Right? Those thingies. So I found one of those thingies on the ground. And so I always make use of those opportunities to earn merits for myself. So when I saw one of those, and there was an Anagarika Puta by my side, and I said, Puta, would you like to earn some merits? And he said, of course. Swami Nasa, what can I do for you? I said, why don't you pick that up? Which he very happily did. Soon after I invited him to do so. And then I said, most people don't realize that the reason they get, that they're wounded, they end up being wounded. So you get wounds on your body, right? The reason you get wounded is because you do things like that. If you make ugly something that is sanctified, something that is pretty, something that is beautiful, something that is nice, then if that is what you give, then that is what you shall get back. See, no one likes to see those things on the ground, do they? The release lining. Thank you. Every day is a school day. Where better than to learn something like that at school, right? It's called a release lining, by the way. Yes? I get that right? Okay. A release liner. So the release liners, aka the thingies. So I explained to him, I said, the reason that people get wounds is because they drop these things as they walk around. And the other most common one are those, when you take paracetamol. Now, what are they called? I think they're called blister packs. Yes, thank you. So those blisters, you take the paracetamol out or any, usually it's paracetamol because that's what you see. That's what people most of the time have with them. And what do people tend to do? They just throw it on the ground. And no one likes to see it there. It's called litter. People don't realize that littering is also a sin of sort. Who has the right to litter? No one does. We don't have the right to litter. It is our duty and our responsibility to keep what is beautiful, beautiful. to keep what is pretty, to keep what is clean, clean. That is our responsibility. Because we share this world with everyone. Although we might think that a part of this world is ours or part of this world is mine, this is only an idea that we have in our own minds. Nothing really belongs to you in the absolute sense. It's only in a conventional sense that things belong to us, and you have begun to understand this truth. But what people don't realize is sometimes that might be the cause of your headache. So what do people tend to do? They take the paracetamol out and then they throw the blister plaque on the ground. When someone sees that, someone else sees that, it's not a pleasant sight, is it? It gives them some amount. I'm not going to say that they're going to go and jump off a cliff when they see that. But it gives them some amount of unhappiness. To some degree, even to the slightest degree, it gives them, it takes away their peace of mind. It takes away their happiness. It's not a joyful sight. So when you deprive someone of what could have been a pleasant sight, now you shall be deprived of the same. Therefore, one of the best ways to avoid getting a headache is to not throw those blister packs on the ground when you treat yourself for a headache by taking the pills out, and because that's what people tend to do. One of the best ways to avoid getting these wounds is to not throw those release liners on the ground when you use your plaster. I mean, use a bin or just put it in your pocket, go home and discard of it, you know, as you're supposed to. We must all conform to convention. Nature is a beautiful thing. It's only bad intent, ill intent that desecrates nature. But nature itself is sanctified. You know, we build a monastery, we build a church, we build a mosque, and then we tell ourselves that that place is holy. Don't we? We tend to do that. So when you walk into the monastery, you'll feel that the monastery is holy. When you walk into the shrine room, you will tell yourself that that place is holy. So what about the space outside of that? Is that not holy? Think about it for a second. So the church is holy. What about the neighbor's garden? What if there's a playground next to the temple? Is that place not holy? It all depends on what you mean by holy. See, if your mind is holy, then everything you see is holy. If your mind is holy, everything you touch is holy. Have you heard, sometimes in stories you'll have heard, that there were people who the things they touched turned to gold? You've heard of that? Sometimes we tend to discard them as just fairy tales, don't we? They touch it and it turns to gold. Literally, that might not be true, but metaphorically, there's a much deeper meaning there. You can become someone for whom everything they touch turns to gold. You can become someone to whom everything they see turns to gold. It all depends on the way you look at something. If you are a blessing to this world, ladies and gentlemen, then wherever you are, that place is blessed. If you speak good, kind, wholesome words, then wherever you are, then that place is blessed. If your actions are always wholesome, you abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, and your conduct is always meritorious, then wouldn't you agree with me that everything you touch turns to gold? See, take this for instance. This was just offered a few moments ago. It was offered to the Mahasangha, to the Swami Mahanse, and an invitation was made to deliver a sermon, to share the timeless truths that help people to come out of their own suffering and experience the joy that life has to offer, to experience true unconditional happiness. because it was offered with that intention. You may not see it with your eyes, but if you look at it closer, you will realize, you will see that this is now pure gold. Because this was offered with that intention. How precious is gold? What is the value of gold? Now you've got to pull out your phone and check on the stock market. Why? Because you know gold prices fluctuate, don't they? Prices fluctuate. So if prices fluctuate, then that means that gold has no intrinsic value. Yes or no? What is the most precious metal? It all depends now. Because it all fluctuates. Whatever there is in abundance is usually of not much value. But did you know that there is more gold, or rather there is more diamond in this world than there is gold? So how come diamonds are more precious than gold? How come diamonds are more expensive? It is what the market is. So no metal has an intrinsic value. Silver does not have an intrinsic value. Gold does not have an intrinsic value. Platinum does not have an intrinsic value. Diamonds don't have an intrinsic value. None of these things have an intrinsic value. But goodness, now that has an intrinsic value. Goodness, not the metal. Goodness has an intrinsic value. I'll prove the point to you. If I gave you a gold biscuit and I asked you how much it is, you'd have to check the market to let me know how much it is, because the market prices fluctuate. So on any given day, you will not be able to tell me you would not be able to give me an intrinsic value for gold unless you check the market price. Yes or no? Yeah, on any given day, you'd have to check the price before you tell me. But I ask you this question. Compassion. Compassion. Is that something you have to check on the market before you tell me how valuable it is? Compassion? What about kindness? Generosity? Patience? Treating people with dignity? See, these are things that are priceless. Because they don't have prices that fluctuate. They don't have market values that fluctuate, ladies and gentlemen. Because they have an intrinsic value. This is how the universe values things. To you, the Sri Lankan rupee might be of some value. The dollar might be of some value. The pound, the sterling pound might be of some value. But if we had Martians invade us, how much would you think they're going to exchange Martian dollars to US dollars? To them, this money would be useless. See, all these values are only conventional. But there are some things in this world that have absolute values. Those are the values that we try to instill and inculcate in our own hearts and minds. Those are what we call virtues. Goodness, kindness, generosity, charity, caring for others, respect, humility, humbleness, these things. That is how you become valuable. That is why when you walk into this hall, you walk in through those doors, your net value is not the amount of money you have in the bank. It's not how much wealth you have. It's not how much property you have. It's not how much jewelry you have. It's none of those things. Your net value, ladies and gentlemen, is the amount by which you have given yourself up in the service of others. That is your net value. Why to this day do we get down on our knees in front of the cross? Why to this day do we get down on our knees in front of the Buddha? Why to this day do we get down on our knees at the mosque as we make a prayer to God Almighty, as you make a prayer to the Buddha, as you make a prayer to Jesus, why do you do that? What was their value? How much did they actually have? The answer is none. When Jesus died on the cross, what was his net worth? All he had was the cloth that covered him. That was it. That was it. How much did the Buddha have? Two pairs of robes and an alms bowl. That was it. Nothing else was his. See? But yet, they have become deserving of every woman, man, and child. Every human being's worship. How do they become worthy of that worship? What is their net value? What is their true value? We hear that the whole universe is indebted to them. The whole world is indebted to them. But what do they actually have? Nothing at all. So how did they become valuable? They became valuable by becoming someone of value, not by having something of value. You must understand the difference between these two things. If you are someone who has something of value, ladies and gentlemen, remember this and remember this well. If you are someone who has something of value, it is only someone else who values that thing that will value you. Actually, it's not you they value, it's the thing that you have. When you have pockets full of money and you walk into the showroom or you walk into a shop, they will welcome you with a smile on their face. The shopkeeper will say, "Good morning, madam. How lovely it is to see you today." What are they after? You know the answer. Who are we fooling around here? As you walk into the car showroom, "Oh, how lovely it is to see you today, sir. Please do come in. Can I show you around and show you some of our best motors?" What are they after? You know what they're after. You may remember this from school, you may remember this from the workplace. If you are someone who is affluent, then people like to hang around you. But you can't really call them friends. They are people who come to you because they want something else from you. They're not there for you when you don't have it. Has life not taught you this lesson? Enough times and more? When you have plenty, there are plenty of people around you. When you have nothing, not even the dog barks when you come back home. See? That's why. Don't be someone whose value is determined by the amount of something that you have. All of these things that you have, they'll be gone. The fire takes some of it. Winds take some of it. The water takes some of it. Time takes the rest of it. In the face of death, all of this is gone, isn't it? All these things that you think are valuable, it's all gone in the face of death. You see, death is the greatest equalizer. Don't you think? It's the greatest equalizer. What do I mean by that? It matters not whether you're a king or a beggar or an emperor or a successful businessman. When death comes, what does death do? It equalizes all of you. You could say I'm a billionaire, the other could say I'm a trillionaire, the other could say I've got nothing with me. I'm just a very poor man. As soon as you walk through the door of death, how much does the billionaire have? Nothing. And the trillionaire? Nothing. The businessman, how many businesses does he take as he walks through the door? Nothing. The poor man? He doesn't know anything's changed. He's none the wiser. See, death is the greatest equalizer. And we're all bound for that. It's bound to come to all of us. We live our lives thinking that we are better than others. We are bigger than others. We are more than others. Sometimes we live our lives like that. There may be times you will find yourselves feeling like that about yourselves. But don't be fooled. This is only because death still hasn't got you. The moment you walk through that door of death, you are all equal. At that point, it is the universe that determines your value. And the universe cares not how much you have in your pocket. Because after you walk through that door, you will have nothing with you. Not a thread to your name. You will be as naked as you were when you first came into this world. Therefore, whether you're black or white matters not. Once you walk through that door, whether you're young or old matters not. Whether you're man or woman still matters not. Whether you're a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Christian, none of these matter. The moment you walk through that door, all that matters is what you have done and what you have left undone. That's it. So we must now redefine the value of our lives, ladies and gentlemen. The value of our lives must not be determined by what you have. It should be defined by who you are. So what really matters is who you are. Especially who you are when you are alone. It's not the face that you show to others. It's not the face that you'd like others to think. It's not the mask that you wear when you have friends. When you have friends over, you wear a mask. When you step outside, you wear a mask. It's not that. When you go to the temple, you wear a mask. That's not what matters. The answer to what your value is, the answer you get when you ask your conscience, who are you? Don't ask me. I'm not your conscience. Your true value is the answer you get when you ask your conscience who you are. Ask your conscience who you are, and your conscience will reply. And then check whether you're comfortable with that answer. If you're comfortable with that answer, then good. Because once you walk through that gate, it is that will determine what happens next. Actually, you know, people like to do this a lot. That is, people like to know where they'll be born once they die. Don't they? Especially people who believe in life after death. People who believe in life after death, there's one thing that they love to know, love to learn, and that is where they're going to be born or what they will be, what will become of them once they are dead, once they die. Well, now, usually when people have this question, they tend to come to Swami Nuhanse and they try and ask us, Swami Nuhanse, what will happen to me when I'm dead? Swami Nuhanse are just very normal, average people. You know, they're just average people. Just because I'm in a robe doesn't mean I've somehow got some spiritual powers or some very special powers that tell me where you're going to be born after you're dead. I don't get such a thing, no. Then they wish, oh, if only the Buddha were still here, we could have gone and asked him. Then you think, maybe if we ask the astrologers, maybe they can let us know where we'll be born. Perhaps if you go and ask someone who can prophesize the future, where will I be born once I'm dead? See, you don't have to work so hard. I have a very simple way to find out what will happen to you once you're gone. There's a very authentic source for this information. No, you don't have to go to the temple. You don't have to go to the church. Don't go looking for Allah. You don't have to trouble yourself and worry yourself so much. There's a very simple way to find out what's going to happen to you once you're gone. That is, ask your conscience. Ask your conscience. The way I like to think of conscience is like this. When God created man, He put in a little bit of Him into each and every one of you. That is your conscience. So if you want to speak to God, if you want to know what He thinks of you, what must you do? Just ask your conscience. Ask Him. Ask your conscience. It'll be as good as going to God and asking Him directly any question you want to ask God about your future, about your past, about what will happen to you. Ask your conscience. And the best thing is your conscience never lies. There's one voice you can always trust. No, not your husband, ladies. Although they might like to think that you always trust. And not the wives either, gentlemen. There's one voice you can always trust. Not even the Swami Nuhanse. There's one voice you can always trust, and that is the voice of your conscience. Your conscience has never lied to you. It has always been true to you. Do you agree with me or not? Has your conscience ever lied to you? No. Whenever you've done something bad, and you asked your conscience, hey, what do you make of that? Surely that was all right, given the circumstances? And your conscience says, that's what your conscience says. You can fool anyone but not me. That's what your conscience says. So no matter what you do, ladies and gentlemen, be true to your conscience. Because that is the one voice that only you hear. No one else will hear that voice. And therefore, no one else can guide you based on what your conscience says. No one else can hear your conscience and therefore tell you what you're doing is right or wrong. People can only observe your behavior. If you pick your nose, I can look at that and say, that's not right. You shouldn't be doing this in public. But that's only because I see your behavior. But I can't see the intention with which you do it. Your conscience is the accumulation of all your intentions. If you put all of your intentions together, that is your conscience. In your conscience is not a record of what you've done, but why you have done it. I don't know where all this is coming from today. Must be the mask. Your conscience has no record of what you have done. That's what memory is there for. Memory has a record of everything you have done. I can remember the other day you told me this. I remember. And I remember what I told you. Again, I remember. Don't you remember? I can ask you. This is all in our memory. So the what is in your memory and the why is in your conscience. Your future is not determined by your actions. Your future is determined by the why behind your actions. And I'll tell you why that is. What happens to you tomorrow is determined by the vipaka that you create today. What happens to you tomorrow is determined by the vipaka that you create today. Your karma today becomes your vipaka tomorrow. Your karma is not a record of what you have done. It is not a record of what you have done, ladies and gentlemen. Your karma is a record of why you have done it. Chetanaham bhikkave kammang vadami is the Buddha's words. Intention, volition is karma. Volition is not what you have done. It is why you have done it. What people around you will observe is only the what you do. Therefore, don't make decisions based on what people say about you. Don't base your decisions on what people say about you. Because they don't see why you're doing something. They can only see what you're doing. So just because you get praise, you get honor, people admire, just because you get that, don't be fooled to think that is the right thing to do. And just because people condemn, people admonish, or people mock, or people ridicule, don't be fooled to think that is not what you should be doing. Perhaps your friends don't admit or don't admire, don't condone you spending your Sundays here. Perhaps you have become the laughingstock now. Those days when they heard your name, everyone talked very favorably of you because you are the one, you are the party animal. Because every weekend there was something or the other happening at home. You are the one who got everyone together. It was at your home people got together. So Saturdays and Sundays were, you know, that was where things happened. But now, not so much, maybe not at all even. Because now your life has been committed, devoted, dedicated to something else. So today, people don't speak very highly of you. They don't really care much about you at all even. They don't invite you to the parties anymore. They don't talk about you in the social circles. You are off the Christmas card list. You don't get one anymore. Not even a Vesak card for that matter. Not even a Vesak card. You're not invited to the birthday parties anymore. I mean, heck, they've forgotten you are alive, so you don't get birthdays. You don't get birthday gifts either. So therefore, you have fallen out of the admiration list. You don't get praise. You don't get honor. They don't call you anymore. But don't let that determine your next steps. Don't let that determine your next steps. See, I'm the same. People who used to go to school with me, my school friends, my work friends, I don't even think that they know I exist anymore. We don't keep in contact. I mean, you know, if they visited me at the monastery and I was available, of course, you know, I would talk to them for a couple of minutes for old time's sake. But ever since I ordained, not more than one or two of my old friends visited me. Maybe they are scared. They're afraid. They're afraid that I might they're afraid that I might ordain them. Some of them are afraid to listen to the Dhamma for fear that what happened to me might happen to them. Beware the monk. for he might rid you of all your attachments. So always remember, ladies and gentlemen, there's a voice deep inside of you. That voice will always speak out. No matter how much you try to quieten that voice will always be there. If you are a God believer, then I tell you that is what God planted inside of you. He put a little piece of Him into every man, woman, and child that He created. So listen to that voice. Don't ignore it. If you're not a God believer, then I tell you that conscience is the aggregation of all your intentions. It is a record of why you have done the things that you have done in your life. So listen to that, because that will give you a picture of what is yet to come. It is your karma that has formed it. In there you will find either a Brahman or a Vasala. Najaccha vasalo hoti, najaccha hoti brahmano. Kammana vasalo hoti, kammana hoti brahmano. It is your actions, rather your volitions, your intentions, that determine whether you are a Brahman or whether you are a low caste. This was a sermon that was delivered in a country where the caste system was the... It was all-consuming. So people cared a lot about which caste each and every other person was. To which the Buddha's response was, it is not your birth that determines your caste. It is the intentions behind your actions that determine your caste. Whether you are a high caste individual or a low caste individual is determined only by the intentions behind your actions. And that is the same thing I'm saying today. In other words, your conscience will tell you what kind of a character you are. So you need not be a crowd pleaser. You need not be a people pleaser. You need not even be a God pleaser. If you truly want to be a genuine heart, a genuine soul, there's one voice inside of you to whom you cannot lie, to whom you cannot put on a mask, to whom or whom you cannot deceive, ladies and gentlemen, that is your conscience. Live a life that is always truthful to your conscience. Let not your conscience accuse you. Let not your conscience accuse you. There's only one voice from whom you must expect praise, honor, and that is the voice of your conscience. If your conscience praises you, if your conscience honors you, if your conscience respects you, then you have lived a good life. If your conscience condemns you, if your conscience accuses you, if your conscience admonishes you, then there is something about your life that it is time to change. That is what these sermons are for. To help you be at peace with your conscience. Because when everyone else is gone, there's still someone in the room with you. That is your conscience. People don't suicide. People don't commit suicide because they can't live with everyone else. That's not why people commit suicide. People commit suicide because they can't live with themselves. Because there's a voice from within, and that voice just doesn't go quiet. There's no mute button on that. So they choose death, because they think death is the mute button. So they think once they take their life, then their conscience will go silent. But that is not true. Because when you commit suicide, all you're doing is breaking your body, not your conscience. You can't break your conscience like that. Your conscience can only be healed. Ignorance and attachment ails the conscience. Wisdom heals the conscience. I really don't know where all of this is coming from today. But take it while it comes. Ignorance and attachment ails the conscience. There's nothing you can do that can change the past. You know that. There's nothing you can do that can change the past. But I know inside of you there's a voice that wishes it could. I'm sure there are things of your past, if you could, you would go back and erase or undo. There will be those among you who are looking for the Control Z button. So you can click undo, 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 undo. You're looking for that button. You're looking for the undo button. You're rummaging around your mind trying to find it and it's not there. So every time you're reminded of something that you were not proud of, even at the time you did it. See, if you make a mistake somewhere, a mistake that was not deliberate, even when you are reminded of it, your conscience doesn't accuse you, does it? Let's say, for instance, you took something. You thought it didn't belong to anyone. You genuinely thought that it had no owner. Right? You took something and you walked away, you start using it, you made it your own. Later on you realize that actually, no, it belonged to someone. Even when you learn that, your conscience doesn't accuse you, because at the point at which you did that, you took it, your conscience was still clear. So your conscience will not accuse you. It won't accuse you retrospectively. Your conscience never accuses you retrospectively. Unless when you first committed that deed, you were still guilty. Oh, then it will. That's called grief. It's called sorrow. It's called regret. So never fear if when you do something, if your conscience says it's the right thing to do, sometimes it might even be unlawful, maybe even illegal, but you don't know. I admit, ignorance is... You can't use ignorance in the face of the law. But at the point at which you commit it, if your conscience does not accuse you, then your conscience is not going to accuse you retrospectively. So it's fine. You need to be aware of what the law is and be always on the right side of the law. But I'm talking about your conscience now, not about the law. You know, there are inmates in prisons whose conscience is clear. Perhaps they were incarcerated for the wrong reason. Maybe they didn't know that what they were doing was wrong. There are a good few inmates in prisons. We've done sermons in prisons, and there are people who didn't know that what they were doing was wrong. And they had no intention to hurt or to harm or to do ill will. But they later realized that that action they'd taken was wrong, and now they're in prison. But their conscience doesn't accuse them. Maybe the Constitution accuses them, but not the conscience. Because the Constitution is a conventional artifact. It's a construct. Whereas your consciousness, not your consciousness, but your conscience, is not a conventional artifact. Once again, it is the accumulation, it's the aggregation of all the intentions behind every word uttered, every action done, and every thought that you rejoiced in. So let's bear that in mind as we conduct ourselves. This is a school, ladies and gentlemen, in more ways than one. This is a school where we come to learn how to be at peace with our conscience. So if you know people who struggle, not with others, but with their conscience, not necessarily with others, but with their conscience, then bring them to this school so that we can open up a gateway to their Nibbana. Nibbana is nothing more than to be at peace with your conscience. See, in very simple terms, that is what Nibbana is. It's the moment where you realize you are now at peace with your conscience. See, in very simple terms, that's what Nibbana is. There's a Parinibbana which happens when you die. Let's not worry about that because there's nothing for us to do there, per se. But I'm talking about Sopadisesa Nibbana. Nibbana, while you're still alive, is the moment in your life, ladies and gentlemen, when you realize, I am now at peace with my conscience. If that day is yet to come for you, then I hope that that day will come to you sooner rather than later. But like I said, it is wisdom that heals the conscience. So if your conscience still accuses you, if your conscience still is still heavy, if it still feels burdensome, then there's only one thing that's lacking. That is wisdom. That is wisdom. Because ignorance and attachment always, it ails the conscience. So what have you come here for then? Wisdom. Wisdom which heals the conscience. So what is Nibbana then? Nibbana is when you are at peace with your conscience. This is not about silencing the conscience. It's not about that. I'm not ever going to prescribe a form of meditation in which you block out all your thoughts. No, we don't do that. I'm not saying that that is wrong. Who am I to say that? But that is not the school of thought we have here. It is not what we practice here. This is not about forgetting your memories, not erasing your memories. It's not about that. This is not hypnosis. This is about being at peace. Being at peace with literally everything. And most of all, your conscience. To be at peace with your conscience, there has to come a point where you realize that it was not you who did it. And it was not to you it happened. You have to find the self and then exterminate it. Easier said than done, isn't it? But that's okay. Practice and it will happen. So, before we begin then, before we begin part two of this sermon, let us all bring our palms together to make our veneration to the greatest teacher we have ever seen, our master, our guide, the fount of all wisdom, to his infinite compassion, to his infinite wisdom. We make this veneration, and as we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our respect or obeisance to the Buddha, but it is a reflection, a contemplation that the Buddha represents the ultimate destination, which is the realization of the truth. The Dhamma represents the path or the truth itself, and the Sangha represents our practice to help us navigate the path to achieve that truth, to achieve that realization. So with that in mind, let us pledge our allegiance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. Let us remind our purpose of being here and resolve to be steadfast on this journey until the end, until we all achieve the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. So with that in mind, let us chant the Namaskara, seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, observe the precepts, invite the Devas, Brahmas and those who are deserving of this sermon, and make and commence with today's proceedings. So for that, please repeat with me.
Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas. Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas. Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas.
As I mentioned the word suicide, I just thought it might be interesting to get a glimpse of what happens beyond what the eye sees. Hopefully this is not a lesson that you will ever need. And thank you for the reminder. So if you have a mobile phone on you, kindly put it on silent. Video is ready? Okay. So before we talk about suicide, the retreat. If you recall, a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think, I shared with you that two of our monks are currently touring the UK and that they were going to organize a retreat, that a retreat had been planned. And I extended the invitation to you all as well, so you could pass on the message to your friends and families and so on. So I think the word got out and we got to hear that it was quite a successful retreat. It was so successful that a video has been done and they have sent the video to us. So I will share the video with you. This is to give you an opportunity to rejoice in the goodness that happens, supported, of course, by your efforts, by your contributions and all of that. When Mahindahandra and Bakkulahandra, who were the two monks who traveled, when they first became anagarikas at the monastery, they were only lay individuals. From there on, it was the sasana that nurtured them. It is the sasana that taught them the truth, the Dhamma. It is the sasana that gave them a teacher. It is the sasana that fed them, the sasana that sheltered them, the sasana that healed them when they were unwell, and the sasana that clad them. The four requisites were provided to them, just as much as the teaching of the Buddha. The teachings of the Buddha, ladies and gentlemen, we can pass on. That is our duty. Starting from Guru Handru and all of the other teachers at the monastery, that is our duty. We pass on the teachings. But for everything else, we have to rely on you. And so, all these efforts that you see going on at the monastery, outside the monastery, with support from the monastery, we are all together in that. The teachings alone cannot make the monk, because there's a code of conduct that we must adhere to. There's a way in which this robe has to be sewn. It is all part of the Buddha's dispensation. If I was not fed, I'd die of hunger. And the best I can do is go begging. But you have taken away the hassle of going out begging for alms, because you take alms to the monastery and you offer it. I wouldn't complain if you didn't, but it would take away more of my time that I could otherwise spend either doing a sermon, giving a teacher's meeting, helping form, transform, develop something for the monastery, So these are ways in which you save my time. If you didn't offer robes, then my recourse would be to go to the cemetery. That is where we are supposed to collect our robes from. You don't find robes at the cemetery, but what you find are all bits of cloth strewn around. Actually, in this day and age, you don't find that either. So if the devotees didn't step in, monks would have to be almost naked. Because back in those days, they didn't have these coffins and all that. They just wrapped dead bodies in a cloth and then they left it in the cemetery. In fact, what they did with the corpse was they left it in the cemetery for Mother Nature to take its course. But now, even after death, we fight with nature, don't we? That's why you lock it and seal it in a coffin. If possible, people would make it out of iron. Or maybe titanium. But that was how it used to be. People left it out in nature. So Mother Nature would then take its course, as it always had done. So there were animals who would come and feed on the corpses. But that was there. That was the way that the ecosystem works. That was how it happened. So they didn't have to worry about festering corpses and things like that. It was all done at the cemetery. But now we have, of course, changed our ways. We are very different in the way we think. Now we always want to keep and retain forever and ever and ever and ever, as long as we can. Even if the whole world burns and collapses and burns down, as long as my coffin is there still, or my father's coffin, my mother's coffin, and my coffin, whatever is, still remains after the fire, still okay. When the next world is created, we will take it to the next world, a new world, and start there again. People are so reluctant to let go, even after death. Anyway, that's a discussion for another day. But what I was saying was, if our devotees didn't offer robes to us, what we would have to do is go to the cemeteries where there are no clothes now and somehow find something and then bring it back to the monastery, stitch it all together, then dye it and then wear it. But that would take up a lot of our time. And that time is not a waste for me because I can contemplate while I do it. But I can't do that and preach at the same time, can I? So then there would be no Sunday sermons like this. There would be no 5-hour long Saturday sermons. Ah, that's a thought. You can all go home early. There would be no counseling sessions at the monastery or anything like that because monks would have to be quite busy just to sustain even something as simple as going on alms, getting themselves a robe. And when they're ill, again, the monks would have to go on foot to find some medicine. Whereas now, you don't have to. Whenever I clear my throat, several of you will come up here with your strepsils and your cough syrups and all sorts, and you leave it on the desk. That's how much you love the Swami nuances. Not Swami nuhanse, Swami nuhanses. That is how much you love them. That's how much you want to care for them. And I admire that. It's almost in your DNA to look after those who look after us. Isn't that the intention with which you do it? So, admire that, truly. So what I was saying was, Mahindahandra and Bakulahandra and various other Swaminuhanses, Anagarika Mahatmyas, right? They're doing this sasana service, outreach work outside of the monastery, in the other countries, because of the collective efforts of all of us. There are some of you who spend time teaching languages to our monks and our Anagarikas. And that's such a great giving, because without the power of language, how would we be able to express ourselves? We may understand the truth, but if that cannot be expressed in a language that they understand, right, the listener understands, then you can't get the message across. All of this is a collective effort, ladies and gentlemen. And this is why I want to show this video to you. Watch it. There may be individuals there who will have experienced something like this for the first time. So what you see there as the two monks are actually the products of our collective contribution. The teachers having taught the Dhamma, the Buddha, the Arahatun Vahanses who preserve the Sasana, the devotees that are you, who have contributed to the upkeep of the monastery, of the Swami Vahanses, this is the reward that we all get. So watch it, rejoice in it, and be part of it in your heart and soul. Does that not just fill your heart with joy? Just the fact that so much goodness is happening out there. People who are giving up their time, their energy, their wealth, whatever they have to heal. It's beautiful, ladies and gentlemen. It is what we were born to do. This is what we were born to do. If you don't believe me, ask God. Why did you put man on this earth? Ask God if you don't believe me. Why did you put man on this earth? Was it to conquer other lands? Was it to fight with your neighbors? Was it to take what belonged to others and make it yours somehow? Was it to spread fear, anger, animosity, jealousy, greed, and hatred? Or was it to represent Him on earth? The Bible says that God created man in His shape. Why does shape only have to mean physical shape? Actually, we don't know what shape God is. But our hearts can take that shape. Our thoughts can take that shape. Our task, ladies and gentlemen, to be on, while we are on this planet, is to be a representative of the power that put us here, of the force that put us here. Don't you always think that you are a representation of your parents? Like when you do something bad, you'll have heard your teachers, maybe even at school, if you remember those days, teachers used to tell you, right? Don't do such things because your conduct looks bad upon your parents. Yeah? And when you do something good, they always admire not only you, but your parents. Usually, I've heard this personally, and I've heard it said to others. In the staff room, they'll talk about if some child has done something good. Whose child is that? They talk about that. And if the child has done something naughty, something mischievous, the same conversation. So we are a representation of the powers that put us here. That is what I mean. That's why, you know, if you come to the Sunday sermons, and then you, outside of the Sunday sermons, if you behave badly, then please don't say that you go to the Sunday sermons. Keep that quiet until you're prepared to be an ambassador of Gateway to Nibbana. Don't share that with anyone unless and until you're prepared to be a representative of this great initiative we have here, of this community, really. It should be one for all and all for one. Each and every one of you have a duty, ladies and gentlemen, to represent this entire community when you're outside of this venue. So when you're in the supermarket, when you're out on the streets, when you're at your friend's place, when you're at your aunt's place, yeah, when you're at work, you represent this community. Let's not forget that. So when you're out there, you have to represent the power that put you there. So then our purpose on this earth then is to represent the powers that put us here. You don't think that it was the devil that put you here, right? Anyone? My father's the devil. No one says that. Even people who believe in God will say, it was God who put us here. Well, then if God put you here, then your task, your responsibility is to be a representation of what God must be like. What does the Buddha say? Your good deeds put you here. A bad deed would not have given you birth as a human being. Agreed or not? Yes? Yeah. So it was a good deed that brought you birth in the blissful plane. Then be a representation of that. See, it doesn't matter here what your definition is of God. This is very religion agnostic. You know this, the way that these sermons flow. I can teach to you how to attain Nibbana through the Bible, through the Quran, through the Bhagavad Gita, or through the Tripitaka, whichever one you want. Because what I teach is not a religion. What I teach you is the truth that governs everything in this universe, of which we are all simply a part. So whichever rules and principles and laws apply to the whole universe, they apply to each and every one of us the same. None of us are immune, and therefore none of us can be indifferent. Then it is our responsibility to be a representative of the powers that put us here. Don't forget, first and foremost, your parents put you on this earth. They gave birth to you. So your task is to be a representation of what your parents stood for. Everyone has weaknesses, everyone has faults, everyone has flaws. That is true. But what your parents wanted for you was always goodness. They dreamt of nothing but good for you. They wanted nothing but good for you. And they wanted to make you the best version of them. That's what they wanted. If they were 60% good but 40% bad, they didn't want you to take one bit of that 40%. Don't you agree with me? They wanted to take 60%, the 60% that was good about them, and then multiply that. That's what they wanted. Even to this day, if we spoke to your parents, they would say that you are the most wonderful child. They will only speak good of you. That's what parents are like. In their eyes, their children are God's angels. Only you know the truth. But that aside, our task then is to be a good representation of our parents and then our teachers. And then the precepts that you adhere to, the precepts that you observe, you've got to be a good representation of that. You can't observe the five precepts and then go lying to people. Then you're not a representation of the truths, of the precepts that you have observed. You can't call yourself a Buddhist. You can't call yourself a Christian. You can't call yourself a good Muslim. You can't call yourself a humanist and then go hurting others. Can you? Then can I ask you this question? What do you make of a human that hurts another human? Are they a good representation of the powers that put them there? What do you think? What do you make of a human that goes around hurting other human beings? Are they a good representation of the powers that put them there? No. What do you make of a human that goes hurting other animals? Are they a good representation of what put them there? Well, you see, you get the answer then. That's why to kill is wrong. To hurt is wrong. To harm is wrong. It doesn't matter whether on the other end it's a human being or any other kind of being. To hurt, to harm, to kill is wrong because it is not a good representation of the powers that put you there. So then our purpose, ladies and gentlemen, on this earth is to be a good representation of that. That's why that video and the things that you see, that all the goodness that happens in this world, it fills our heart with joy. And it must do the same for you. You were placed on this earth to do good to others. You can start with your family. That's fine. Start with your family. The people who you care the most about. Every child has a parent, too. Every child has a mother, every child has a father. No one is born spontaneously. Everyone has a mother, everyone has a father. At least an adopted mother or father. You can start with them. That's one of the greatest, best places to start, because it give, you know, actually, it's amazing that it's like that. It's one of the simplest places to start, but it's one of the ones that give you the most reward. Amazing, it's like that. Because to treat your parents well, earns you a lot of merits. Just as much as hurting them, harming them, doing ill will towards them, earns you a lot of demerit. You can consider your mother and father to be arahants at home. Treat them with that level of respect and devotion. They are your arahants at home. So if they are still alive, do what you can, because you have a pair of arahants at home. To you, they are like that. To each other, they may not be. Ignore that part. That's not for you to decide, that's not for you to determine. That's a different kind of relationship. But to you, they are arahants at home. So for as long as they're alive, make the most of that opportunity, because once they're gone, you cannot replace them with anyone else. When they're gone, they're gone. We can't get substitute parents. That special bond, that special link, put the bond words to aside, that special link is a very unique link, and you must capitalize on that. Forgive me for using those terms, but you must try and capitalize on that while they're still here. Make the most of their presence. So start at home. And then your siblings. Your elder brother, your elder sister. He was there, she was there for you when you were younger. Maybe they're still there for you. Probably the one person you can go and ask for help without fear of condemnation. Perhaps they're the one person who will not think badly of you, because, you know, you shared the same mother, you shared the same parents, you shared the same home with them, you slept under the same roof. So if you have a really good relationship with your siblings, cherish that, ladies and gentlemen. Unfortunately, not everyone does. In some relationships, not enough time, love, devotion was invested in those relationships. And today, those relationships are almost non-existent. The opportunity was there. They were there. At the beginning, they were there. The brother was there, the sister was there. But like all good gardens that don't get tended to, as weeds start to grow, and then the weeds take over, and then before you know it, it becomes a forest. Nothing of worthwhile, nothing worthy. Then it takes a lot of effort and a lot of time to go back and reset and put things back right. But if you still are privy, if you are still privileged to have a good relationship with your siblings, cherish it. Cherish it. Don't take it for granted. Put your hand up if you have a sibling. I have one too, so I'll put my hand up. See, you are very fortunate. Put your hand up. Thank you. There may have been plenty of times where they saved you from doing something wrong. Maybe you were only very young back then. But if you remember, if you recall, you may reminisce plenty of times where they saved you from doing something that you shouldn't have done. Maybe they saved you as you climbed up on a wall and thought, you know, you were Superman. You were just about to jump, but then Akka came and pulled you back. Aya came and pulled you back. Your Malli came and pulled you back. Said, are you crazy? Oh, they went running to Amma and said, Ayya's gone mad. Mali's gone mad. He's trying to jump off the wall. Maybe they snitched on you, but still saved you. Saved you an arm and a leg. Saved you your life. Let's not forget that, you know, you have a very strong sansaric transaction with them, a very strong sansaric connection. That's why you were born as siblings. You were not born as neighbors. You were born as siblings. So if you still have that, ladies and gentlemen, cherish it. It may be that they're not interested in the Dhamma. Then so be it. Right? If they're not interested in the Dhamma, so be it. You try, do your duty. Maybe introduce the Dhamma to them if you can. Invite them to a sermon or two if you can. If they're not keen on listening to the Dhamma, at least say you can come and offer some alms at the end of the sermon. Maybe they might like that. Perhaps that is their first step. And then they see the Swaminuhasis, they see the Mahasangha, and then they're impressed by how serene, by how tranquil the monks are, and the community, and how welcoming and so loving and affectionate the community is. And that inspires them to come the second time. So maybe all you had to do was bring them in one day. Perhaps that's how you're here today. So cherish it. So this is how you start. Serving your purpose on this earth. Do what God would have wanted you to do. Represent Him. Represent goodness. Be an ambassador for goodness. There will be times that will test your patience though, when you try and do this. You know, good people are good in good times. Great people are good at all times. Good people become bad in bad times, but not the great. But we've got to start first being good. And then we go on to become great. An Aryan who starts at the stage of being a Sotapanna, goes on to become a Sakrudagami, Anagami, and finally an Arahatunuhansi. This is the path to greatness. But goodness is the foundation to greatness. Just like you can't build up a wall without a good foundation, you can't build greatness without goodness. So cultivate every goodness that you can in your life, ladies and gentlemen. Cultivate it. Invest your time in that. Associate with good people. You've got to be discerning now. You've got to be able to discern good from bad. Remember what I said at the beginning of this talk. Just because you get praise, honor, respect, does not mean that what you're doing is right. That does not mean what you're doing is right. If a woman gets naked and walks on a platform, more than half the audience will cheer. They will whistle. Yes or no? They will stand up and give a standing ovation. They say, encore, encore. So she's getting praise. She's getting an applause. People will say, well done. They said, can you turn around and do that again? But that doesn't mean what they're doing is right. That's what I said. Just because someone praises you, honors you, gives you an applause, doesn't mean what you're doing is right. Who do you ask in these moments? conscience. Ask your conscience. There are some sports. What they do is they put two men into a ring and then they fight each other. If it's done for exercise, I can understand. But then I don't know why they have to hit the other person for that. You can have a sandbag and punch the sandbag. Let's see who punches the sandbag best. Right? The one who drops the sandbag first, he wins. You give him the trophy. But why does it that one has to punch another person so that their face goes red or they get a black eye or the nose breaks? But everyone cheers. They have boards saying, hey, go for it, hey, go, hey, go, right? Cheering. I've seen animals wrestle, but that I believe is something for animals. I don't get it when humans wrestle. I don't get it. That might be something wrong with me. Then if that is go, I apologize. Might be something wrong with me. I don't get it why humans have to wrestle. Humans have to love. Heal, not hurt. Because we have the capacity to heal. In a world where there are doctors who heal, why are there people who wrestle and hurt each other? I don't get that. I don't get that part. But as these two people do it, there will be a whole crowd of people giving a standing ovation, cheering them on, encouraging them to not just break their neck but break their legs. You know you've heard these things, you know you've seen these things, and they are on national television. And it's not your grandpa who watches this. It's your grandson. That's the problem. Young children, these are the ways that they are indoctrinated. That to fight is good. To fight earns you praise. To fight earns you a trophy. You get a cup at the end of it. You get a medal at the end of it. You get a shining belt at the end of it. And people cheer you when you get it. So then people wonder how come children, school-going children, fight with each other. I don't know what the situation is now, these days, but when I was at school, even those days there used to be schools versus schools. It was that bad. There are times when these things like go up and down. Inter-school fights. Do they still have it? Putas, duas? Inter-school fights? No? No more? Teachers? Still goes? Yeah, still goes on, yes. I remember those days when I used to go in the bus. I had to take my school badge off. Because they'd come and catch which school you were based on your school badge. So what some of my friends used to do is they carried multiple badges with them. And there was a time where we had to learn all the school anthems. Because that's one way to check which school you are from. Because if you are from a particular school, then you have to know the school anthem, right? So we had to learn all the school anthems. Just to save ourselves from being attacked. Perhaps the trigger for that was maybe some girl somewhere. Typically it used to be like that. Like she was the last fish in the sea. I mean, I don't understand why for one girl two schools have to fight. I don't get it. I don't get it, so I was never part of any of that nonsense. But the thing is this, it's not necessarily the girl that is the reason for the fight. You know, if there's a girl involved, then people can talk things out, right? When you have a disagreement, you talk things out. That is what people should be taught to do. But that is not what children learn to do. Because at home, there's a TV. And what do you see on TV? People wrestling it out. People wrestling it out. And then when the fight gets dirty, It's not just with their arms and legs, right? You've seen these fights. Then they bring in the furniture. They bring these iron links, chains, and various other sharp objects. You know, later on I heard that they renamed it to entertainment. Just because they didn't want to give out the wrong message. But do you think children actually got the gist of it? You think children got the idea? No, they still watch people fight. We have a responsibility, ladies and gentlemen. If your son or your grandson, if your daughter or your granddaughter sits in front of that TV and this is the kind of thing they watch on TV, I don't blame them. They are not the ones to be blamed. The children are not the ones to be blamed. The people who produce those programs are not the ones to be blamed. The satellite companies who stream these channels, they are not the ones to be blamed. The people who make the television sets, they are not the ones to be blamed. The parents are the ones to be blamed, and I'm sorry to say that. Whether you agree with me or not, you are who to blame. It is you who's to blame. Because they think that that is the right thing to do. When there's a disagreement, fight. Fight it out. Survival of the fittest is the law of the jungle. Amongst humans, that is not the law. It is not the survival of the fittest. That is not what God would want. Fight it out. You can't change society. Believe you me, you can't change society. If it were possible, then by this time it would have been done. Because there are many people who have come and gone and they've all tried to change society. I'm not going to protest against TV channels streaming these programs or write to the president or write to the president of every country in the world, right, or to the media companies and say, stop streaming these programs, it's not right. Right? There's no point in doing that. Because people will always find ways to circumnavigate whatever restriction you put in place. Because when the heart wants something, it will find a way to get it. You know this is true. When your parents locked the biscuit cupboard, yeah, when you were younger, right, the karachoru cupboard, when that cupboard got locked, did you or did you not find where the keys were? Somehow or the other. I did. So surely you must have done. Whatever is forbidden is that much more pleasurable, isn't it? That's how we started with the forbidden fruit. The one tree from which the fruit should not have been eaten. That started all this up. So you see, it's almost a habit. It's in our DNA. Whatever is forbidden is what we want, always. So when the heart wants something, it will find a way to get it. Therefore, no matter what restrictions you put in place, ladies and gentlemen, you cannot save your children, you cannot save yourselves, you cannot save the world by doing that. It has to be through the Dhamma, which is why I say again, redefine your purpose. Your purpose here on this good earth is not to make money. It's not to be educated. It's not to become an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer or any of those things. You can do that, but those should be side things. Things that you do on the side. Side ventures. Your main purpose is to be a representative of the powers that put you here. What is God's job? He's an engineer. So God put you here. What is his job? An engineer? Is he a doctor? Is he a banker? No, God is God. God is God. So if God is God, then your job, your task on this earth is to be a representation of God. He's not a banker. He's not an engineer. He's not a lawyer. He's God. It is your good that put you here. Good is good. Good is not a banker. Good deeds is not a banker. Yeah? Good is what put you here. Previously I said God put you here. Now I'm saying good put you here. It's the same thing. So if good put you here, good is not a banker, good is not a lawyer, good is not an engineer, good is not a whatever. So it must not be our life's purpose to achieve those things. Our life's purpose must be to be a representation of the powers that put us here, which is good. Let's not forget, ladies and gentlemen, you are not in hell. You are not in hell. This is a slice of heaven. Only we call it earth. In comparison to most places where you could have been born, this is a slice of heaven. The best thing about earth is you can make it heaven. You can also make it hell. That is what is great about earth. That's what's different between earth, hell, and heaven. Heaven, you can't make heaven hell. You can't make hell heaven. Don't try, they'll kick you out. Because that's the purgatory, that's where people are to be punished. So don't you go start preaching sermons to people there, won't work. Don't you try to be good in hell, won't work, they'll kick you out. You can't be bad in heaven. Because no sooner than you try to be bad, you get kicked out. Because your physical presence is very subtle in the heavenly abodes. If you turn rotten, then they kick you out. There's no one to kick you out. You are out. Whereas on earth, because we have these solid physical bodies, we can sustain ourselves for about 60, 70 long years. Sorry, 120. Right, no arms today. We can sustain ourselves for 120 long years. And in that 120, you get to choose what you do on earth. That is why, once again, I have to agree with my own saying. God put a piece of him in you. See, if it was God who decided hell should be hell and heaven should be heaven, right? Then he put you on earth and put a little bit of him into you and said, right, now you make the same choices. Isn't that so? So he created hell. He created heaven. But hell could never be made heaven, and heaven could never be made hell. So there's nothing for God to do in those two places, because it's all part and parcel of how it works. It's intrinsic. Whereas earth is not intrinsically good or bad. You can make it what you want it to be. That is where God has something to do. Therefore, he created you and then put in a little bit of him into you and said, right, do what I did. Make it either hell or heaven. But remember this. Here's what God said. I don't know whether you heard that part. If you didn't, then hear me out. God put a little bit of him into you and he said, now it's up to you. I've given you earth. It's neutral. Make it either heaven or hell. But whatever you do, that will happen to you. That's what he said. Whatever you do, that will happen to you. So he gave us a sacred opportunity. He gave you earth and said, yeah, this is earth for you. If you make this hell, then hell will happen to you. If you make this heaven, then heaven will happen to you. Are you making this hell or heaven? So we are all on earth now, as humans. I have a question to ask you now, and I'm asking this question on behalf of God. Wait, I'm just asking him, hold on. I'm his messenger. So he wants me to ask you this question. Are you making this earth a heaven or a hell? To give me an answer to that question, ask your conscience. In your conscience is prescribed, or rather inscribed, your future. In your conscience is inscribed your future. You want to know your future, sir? Madam, would you like to know your future? See, today you have learned how to find out. Now you're a clairvoyant. You have your own one. You don't have to go ask anyone anymore. Ask your conscience. Have you made this earth heaven or hell? You know the answer to this, ladies and gentlemen. It's not the actions, it's never the actions. Because if so, the poor man would never be able to make this earth heaven. If it was the action. Because then it would be very unfair. Because then it would always be our past actions that determine our future. It's not our past actions that determine our future. It's our present actions that determine our future. You need to understand the difference between these two things. Because if you say it's our past actions that determine our future, then there's nothing you can do about it now. Is there? I was bad in the past, so therefore it's going to be terrible in the future. Nothing I can do about it. No. It's not the past actions. It's your present actions. It's always the present action. Even in the past, it was the present actions. Because in the past, what was it then? The present. In the present, of course it's the present. But in the future, again it's the present. So your present actions, not the actions, but the intentions behind the actions will always determine your future. If today you are blessed with a loving family, if you have parents who dote on you, if you have siblings who would give an arm and a limb for you, if you have teachers who would go the extra mile on your behalf, if you have friends who will never abandon you, it is because at some point in your presence, at some point that was a present moment for you, you made earth heaven. That's why you have it now. You made heaven out of earth. See, I'm only here to remind you, ladies and gentlemen, that whatever good comes to you is your own doing. Actually, the long and short of this is, I can't give you anything good and I can't give you anything bad either. So I don't know why you come here every Sunday. I have nothing to offer you besides reminding you that you are your own chef. Cook whatever it is you want to eat. In this restaurant, it's bring your own food. We give the bottle. Bring your own food. Or rather, cook your own food. Here you learn how to cook your own food because you are the chef. I cannot share with you any meal that I have cooked for myself. Unfortunately, I can't do that. As delicious as it may be and as generous as I might be, I cannot give you an ounce of this most delicious food that I have cooked for myself, because it is only for myself. All I can show you is how to cook. So if it's tasty, what you're having tonight, what you're having for lunch, and what you're having for breakfast, if it's tasty, if you like it, if it's delicious, then you can thank whom for that? Thank yourself for that. Whereas if you find it distasteful, if you find it repulsive, if one taste of it makes you want to puke, then again, whose fault is that? It's your own. So don't point your finger at anyone else. We have never eaten a meal cooked by another. All our meals have been self-cooked. This is the simple philosophy, the simple principle of life. These are very simple things, ladies and gentlemen. But in its simplicity is its profoundness. In its simplicity is its profoundness. You might ask me why. Well, the answer is this. It's so simple to do, then why doesn't everyone do it? See, to be good, to have good, what must you do? Be good. Right? If you want to have good, you just have to be good. So why isn't everyone being good? It's simple, isn't it? All you have to do is be good. You don't need money. You don't need to work. You don't need to do any of those things. You just have to be good. That's all. So why isn't everyone doing that? It's so simple. That's the thing. In its simplicity, it's its profoundness. What's easy to do is also easy not to do. Is it not easy to wake up on time? If the alarm rings you, or wakes you up, right? The alarm goes tickety-tick, tickety-tick. Then all you have to do is wake up, isn't it? Because the alarm's doing the hard work. The alarm's doing the hard bit. It's always on time. All you've got to do, you know, you don't even have to wake up. The alarm wakes you up. I mean, I get it if the alarm is not loud enough to wake you up. I get that. Right? Then you put your hearing aids before you go to sleep. But if you can hear the alarm, if it's loud enough, and the alarm wakes you up, not gets you out of bed, that's another matter. I'm talking about waking you up, not getting you out of bed. They are two different things. One is easy to do, the other is almost impossible to do, right? I'm talking about waking up. So when the alarm goes off, you are woken up. See, now it's time to be up. It's easy to do now. You're up. Getting out of bed is also easy to do. It's not difficult to do. All you have to do is swing your legs to either the left side or the right side. Right? Rest your hands on the bed, right, on the mattress, and try pushing yourself up. It works. No, honestly, try it next time. All you have to do is push. And then Newton's laws of motion take over. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. See, even that you don't have to do. Newton did all that for us. Right? All you have to do is push. You don't have to get yourself out of bed. Just push. And the bed will push you back. It's the bed that wakes you up. Or gets you up, not you. You don't even have to do that part. You don't even have to do that part, the bed does that. You push against the bed and the bed gets you up on your feet. So the alarm wakes you up and the bed gets you up. How easy is it? So easy. So why don't you do it? Because what's easy to do is easy not to do. That's why. How easy is it to say thank you? Thank you. The first word is longer, the second one is even shorter. Just in case, you know, someone gets lazy halfway through the phrase, they made the second word shorter, so you don't have to make even that much effort after you made the first one. See, thank That's a long word. You. It's a short, very short word. It's easy, isn't it? Then why doesn't everyone say thank you? Because what's easy to do is easy not to do. That's why. See, I have a word that's even shorter than these two put together and yet even harder to say. Sorry. How many letters is thank you? T, H, A. I'm tired of counting it. N, K, Y, O, U. Oof, right? That's how many? Eight. An eight letter long word. Sorry. S, O, R, R, Y. You can count them on one hand. But you tell me which one's the easier one to say. Thank you or sorry? Which one's the harder one to say? Sorry is the harder one to say, but it's got less letters even. It's got fewer letters. How come it's so hard to say then? Because what is easy to say is easy not to say. It's time you redefined your purpose. Re-engineer yourself every day. Every day. Every day re-engineer yourself. Yesterday's version of you is not something to be proud of. Don't be proud of your yesterday's version. Were you an arahant yesterday? Were you an arahant yesterday? Right, well then, yesterday's version is no good. So today you have to change that. Improve. Something has to be better by the end of today to what you were yesterday. If by the end of today you're not an arahant, then this version of you is still not the best. It's not good. You've got to re-engineer yourself. We learn engineering and then we build rockets. See? We build cars, we build machines, we build computers. We build quantum computers. We build all these great, magnificent, glorious devices. And we surround ourselves with that. But little time do we invest in engineering ourselves. Whereas our purpose on this planet Earth is to keep on engineering ourselves because we were born wrong. We were born wrong. Something was wrong. At least let's die right. What do you say? We were born wrong. What shall we do? Let's all die wrong. When you were born, were you laughing or you crying? Crying. Then, when you're about to die, how do you imagine yourself? Laughing? Being jolly? If so, great. But if you imagine yourself, envisage yourself on your deathbed, right, with or without your friends and family around you. And if you imagine yourself, and in that imagination you see yourself teary-eyed, not just weak in body, but also weak in mind, feeble, very weary, dreading what's about to happen. Fearful of what's about to happen because your conscience is screaming out loud at you, you wicked witch. If that's what your conscience is telling you, just wait until you die. If that's what your conscience is telling you, then you were born wrong and now you are going to die wrong. If you die wrong, you'll be born wrong again. If you die right, on the other hand, if you die right, now because it's right, you don't have to redo it. When do you go back and correct your sums? When you get it right or when you get it wrong? When does your teacher say, no, take it back, check it again, do it again and bring it to me? When does the teacher tell you that? When you've done it right or when you've done it wrong? When you've done it wrong. So why were you born again then? Why did the teacher send you back? Why did he send you back? Because you died? Wrong. That's why. You died wrong, ladies and gentlemen. You didn't even know how to die. Come on. You didn't even know how to die. I mean, to live is difficult. Right? To die, you don't have to do much. Just lay on bed and the reaper comes and takes you. But even that you did wrong. Come on. So what's the point if we are masters in engineering? If you have PhDs in rocket science, and what's the point in that? We know how to engineer the whole world around us, but we have failed to engineer ourselves. Then we are a failure. Don't be vulnerable in your last moments. Don't be vulnerable to fear. Don't be vulnerable to greed. Don't be vulnerable to lust. Oh, no, 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 no. You don't want to find yourself in that place. The 7 deadly sins, as the Bible would say. The 10 unmeritorious deeds, as the Tripitaka would say. Don't find yourself in that place. You won't find yourself in that place, ladies and gentlemen, if you live your present moment right. That's all you got to do. Live your present moment right. So here's what you have to do then. Do try from here on. Let your conscience be your compass. Bring your compass here every Sunday. I will help you calibrate it. Acha. I'll help you calibrate it. I can't give you my compass. That's mine. But you bring your compass. And I'll share with you how I learned to calibrate mine. Because when I saw my teacher calibrating his, and it was a fine compass, I went and asked him, "Can I have that?" I asked my teacher, "Can I have that one? Looks much better than mine." He said, "No, you can't have mine, but I can teach you how to calibrate your compass so it is as good as mine." So ever since, I have been learning how to calibrate my compass. If you want, I can share that knowledge with you. Keep that here, your compass. Keep it here. Make sure you always carry your compass here, where it matters. Here's where it matters. Let it guide you. Be careful about with whom you associate. Be careful about with whom you associate, because every association, how do you make a compass out of a piece of metal? You must have done this at school. Science, basic science, you get a piece of metal and you take the north side of a magnet, right? And then you rub it on that, right? And you take the south side and rub the other end. Then that becomes a compass. Then you suspend it on some pin or something, and then you let it do its magic. See, association. That's what happens. You take that magnet and you associate it. That's what you do. You associate. Frequent contact. Frequent and close contact. So the qualities of one are transferred to the other. They're instilled in the other through close and constant association. then you have no reason to question why the Buddha said, association is the entirety of the sasana. Entirety, association. Then you have no reason to question why I chose this life as a monk. I have come for association. I wanted Sangha association. Dhamma association, Buddha association. Association of the Noble Triple Gem. Because I know that I am just a piece of metal. And the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha are these great big magnets. And they keep on calibrating me. So that when I need my compass, it's always accurate. Because the last thing you want to find is you're in the middle of the desert. Or there's no one to ask for direction. You pull out your compass, and where it should be showing north, it shows south. Now, you are destitute. You know the difference between destitute and helplessness? The difference between destitution and helplessness is, when you are destitute, you don't know that you're helpless. It's when you're lost and you don't know that you're lost. That's when you're destitute. Oh, that's the worst situation to be in. In the Sinhalese, we call it anatha. You don't even know that you are lost. You don't even know that something's wrong. Just imagine, I'll give you a very simple example. Someone taught you that imagine if someone taught you that. Very simple example. Really simple example. Someone taught you that, just imagine that. Now you go living your life thinking that this is true. So wherever you have to pay 4 plus 5, you end up paying 10. So it's costing you more than it should, right? So before you know, you're going to be bankrupt. Because you're paying more than what you were supposed to be paying. But you wouldn't do anything about this. You wouldn't go take another math class because you don't know that something's wrong. It's like, if I give you another simple example, this man's blindfolded. This man's blindfolded. And he's walking up a hill. He'll just keep on walking. Until when? Until he can walk no more. Why can he not walk no more? Or walk anymore? Because he's going to fall. It's a cliff. This is called destitution. This is not helplessness. To elevate this situation from destitution to helplessness, I just took off the blindfold, that's all. I just took off the blindfold. I did not put stairs. No, I didn't do that. I just took off the blindfold. What difference has that made? Now they know that they're in trouble. That's helplessness. Because when you're helpless, you go finding help. You go looking for help. When you're helpless, you go help. You're looking for help, then you're helpful. Helpless, helpful. You go looking for help. But when you are destitute, is there any reason for this man to call for help? With the blindfold on? Is there any reason why he will try to slow himself down as he approaches the edge of this hill. Any reason to slow down? No. And if someone keeps cheering him on, says, yeah, you can do it, you can do it, like you'll be doing in a little while. You know what I'm talking about, right? Good. If you got that, then you're a regular. If you didn't get that, ask a regular. So, if someone cheers them on, you can do it, you can do it. Is there any reason why he must slow down? Or feel hesitant? Reluctant? No, not at all. They'll be intrigued, will be inspired, will be motivated, but motivated to do the wrong thing. That's a state of destitution. We were all once destitute. We were all, you and I. We were all destitute. And then someone showed me the Buddha. Someone showed me the Buddha. Then I realized that I was no longer destitute. But I was still helpless. I knew that there was a problem. I knew that there was a truth that I have to aspire to, but I didn't know how to get there. I didn't know what to do. Then they showed me the Dhamma. You see the journey? When you show someone the Buddha, they're no longer destitute. Now they're helpless. When you then show them the Dhamma, they're no longer helpless. Now they have help. But does it stop there? No. Next up is you helping yourself. You taking that help on. That is what the Sangha is. Practice. That's why we always say, I cannot help you. You have to help yourself. That is the Sangha part. But I can show you that help is there. Help is out there. That's the Dhamma part. You need not fear or be destitute because Buddha is there. That is a destination. So I went and asked my teacher for his compass. He said, no, I can't give you mine. You have to make your own one. But he told me that he will help me calibrate it. And he said, all you have to do is associate. So that's what I devoted the rest of my life to doing. So you must also make sure that you take your compass with you, ladies and gentlemen. May the compass of your, or the conscious, may your conscious, your conscience, not consciousness, I keep saying that. May your consciousness, no, not your consciousness. May your conscience serve as your compass. Make sure that your compass is accurate. If it's not, you have a job to do. When suffering takes over, and suffering comes in many forms, you know, suffering can be fear, suffering can be sorrow, suffering can be grief, suffering can be anger, suffering can be jealousy, suffering can be hatred, suffering can be irritation, annoyance, all of these things. When these things take over, you need to know, you need to come to awareness that your compass is off. It's off. Off as in not switched off as in out of calibration. It's pointing the wrong direction. Because whichever way your compass is directing, that is the way in which your thoughts will form from there on. It's a guide for your thoughts. So that compass, people call it the moral compass, if you like. Ensure that you cultivate values, virtues, and you calibrate your compass. That is your life's purpose. Live a life so that when you die, if you believe in God, God can come and inscribe your tombstone. The day you die, if you believe in God, God will inscribe your tombstone with these words: He was me on earth. Or she was me on earth. Live your life in that manner. If you don't believe in God, that's still okay. But what put you here was your goodness, wholesomeness, your good deeds. Then you don't need anyone to inscribe your tombstone. Because there will be no tombstone for you. Only the goodness that you have left in this world will prevail. You know, think about this for a second. If you are goodness personified, okay? If you are goodness personified, when you are gone, besides the goodness that you have left in the hearts and minds and souls of the people you have touched, what else must remain? What else must remain? Your relics? Your tooth relics? Nowadays it'll be very difficult to find tooth relics because everyone's wearing dentures and all that, right? So, what do you want to be found when you're gone? If you are goodness personified, right? If you are goodness personified and the rest is just flesh and bones, blood, flesh and bones, what else do you want to be left so that people can come and worship and venerate and show their respect to? What else do you want left behind? Why do you want, do you want people to confine you to a box? If you are goodness, how does goodness spread? In the air, like germs do. No, goodness spreads from heart to heart, isn't it? So if you want to be immortal and you are goodness personified, what's the one thing you can do to become immortal? Spread that goodness. Because although you will die, goodness shall remain. And if you are goodness personified, then you shall never die. Goodness will forever remain. That is our purpose on this earth. Yes, of course, we can put our hands in our pockets and then say, how can we recover the world? It's in a terrible state and people are doing up to all sorts of evil. They're getting up to all sorts of evil. They're terrible. People are bad. They're vile. They're vicious. They're wicked. People are killing each other. They're stealing. They're lying. They're backstabbing. They're womanizing. They're abusing. They're rapists and they're murderers and they're terrorists. Right? This is a wretched place to be in. What a terrible world in which we live. Well. Still, God put you here, didn't He? God put you here, right? So it cannot be that bad. If it is that bad, then that's why He put you here, because He put all the bad people in one place and He put you here as well. If you want to believe that, then you must appreciate that that is what God has done, that this is a punishment. This is where He's put all the bad people and He's put you here as well because you're all just as bad. And this is the naughty corner of the 31 realms of existence. But I don't believe in that. I have a different story. I believe that there is still hope. And that is why he put you here. That is what I want you to believe about yourself. There is hope. There is hope for goodness. There is hope for kindness and compassion. There is hope for respect and treating each other with dignity. There is hope for morality and virtuousness. Because there is hope, he put you here. He said, go, do what I would have done if I was there. Or do what I would do if I was there. So that's the story for the God believers. For the non-God believers among you, it was goodness that put you here. Not godness, goodness. Just add another oh if you don't believe in God. One more oh. Goodness. It was goodness that put you here. And goodness still exists in this world, ladies and gentlemen, because there's still hope. You know, in hell, there's no goodness. That's the thing. In the purgatory, there's no goodness because there's no hope. You cannot recover hell. You cannot put it back right. You cannot fix everyone in hell. You cannot do that. They have to spend their time there. They have to pay the price. Once their time is done, once their sentence has been served, then they are released. I don't think you get parole there either. So don't keep your hopes on that. Once your time is served, that is when you're out, because from what I know, once you're there, you can't do good because you don't have association. That's just a simple reason. There are no angels in hell. There are no arahants in hell. There are there's not even a single sotapan in hell. What are you hoping for? Right? There's not even a sotapanna in hell, let alone arahants. Because what is a sotapanna? Someone who has once and forever abandoned the four great hells, right? So you're never going to find a sotapanna there. Therefore, there is no way you can get any kind of noble association. Nil. Nada. None whatsoever. So you can't put hell right. You can't put it right. And you can't ruin heaven either. Heaven is good. You can't ruin it. You can't spoil it. If you begin to spoil it, then you are chucked out. Whereas on earth, you have a choice. That's why he said, whatever you do to this place will happen to you. So we must understand the task that is at hand, ladies and gentlemen. Don't just take your lives for granted. Normally I say don't take your wives for granted, right? Now I say something even more important than that. Don't take your lives for granted, even if you took the other one for granted. Because your lives are here with purpose. Every second you spend now determines the next one. This is not just a life that is living. This is a life that is writing a story that is yet to be told. Your story is being written right now. It's being written right now. You are yet to read it. That's the thing. You are yet to read it. Tomorrow you will read the chapters you are writing today. Unfortunately, you don't get any chance to go and proofread and check and correct your mistakes. You don't get a chance to do that either. So if the grammar is wrong, it's going to be wrong when you read it. If you make a spelling mistake, it's going to be wrong when you read it. If you get the characters mixed up, it's going to be wrong when you read it. It's going to be completely jumble-mumble when you read it if you do it wrong now. So let not just life flow as if all you have to do is just observe and you have nothing to do about it. Don't let just people around you determine what you're going to do next. take charge. Realize that you have a big, important, very significant part to play here. It's not anyone else's life you're messing with, that's the thing. It's yours and yours own. Take this seriously. Make sure you understand your purpose. Start at home. Start with your parents. Start with your siblings. Start with your spouses. Your spouse is another person with whom you have a very strong sansaric connection. For how long, we don't know. But for as long as it lasts, you have a very strong sansaric connection. And if you don't do it right, you will be creating many more chapters for sansara. If there are chapters you will enjoy reading, good. But if there are chapters you will regret writing, then be very careful. Remember this, and remember this well. These are really good practical pieces of advice. Okay? Every person who comes up to you, every person, every individual who comes up to you, is someone to whom you can make an impact, bearing in mind that that impact will come back to you. Today, tomorrow, someday. Everyone you come across in life is the same. Whatever impact you make on them, here is an opportunity for you to decide the kind of impact you want to have upon yourself. Therefore, choose wisely. You cannot choose who comes in front of you, but you can choose how you treat them. Who comes in front of you has already been chosen. How was it chosen? Who chose it? Who chose it? Exactly. You chose it. When? When the chapters were written. This interaction, this one, that was a chapter you had written earlier. Now you're reading it. Now you're reading it. So this you cannot choose now. But what you can choose is how you interact with this association. How you treat the person who comes in front of you, that is yours to choose now. Meaning, it's now your chance to write that next chapter. So, when you step outside these gates, you might be confronted by a beggar. Perhaps unshowered, unshaven, filthy, dirty, smelly, gross. That's not entirely his fault. Do you see that? You don't like the sight, perhaps, but that's not entirely his fault. How come it was your eyes that caught that sight, not mine? Or not someone else's? You are reading a chapter you had once authored. You had once written that chapter. So don't choose the person who comes in front of you. But here's what you can choose. How you treat them. So, should the beggar come up to you and then you insult him or her, you offend him or her, to not offer anything is no insult. If you don't have anything to offer, if you respectfully deny or refuse, right, or say you have nothing to offer, that's not to deny, that's not to insult or offend. But plenty of people do more than just ignore them or deny any support or refuse any support. What they tend to do is they abuse them verbally, typically verbally, sometimes even physically. Now you are writing another chapter. Now you are writing another chapter. So if a priest comes up to you, if a monk walks up to you, If a nun walks up to you, again, this is a chapter that was once written. So it's your time to now read it. Why only to you and not to someone else? Well, that is what we call merit. That is what we call vipaka, really. Merit or demerit, it's what we call vipaka. But that is a chapter that was written previously. But now you have the choice to determine how you are going to write this chapter. You can either, once again, insult, offend, abuse, accuse, and so on. Or you can be respectful, you can be courteous, you can be generous, and write another chapter. See, who's in power now? Who's the only one who decides what happens to you? Who? Exactly. You and you alone. This is why the Dhamma empowers. The Dhamma is not about making you feel that you are subservient to anyone. You are not my servants, neither are you the Buddha's servants. You are not the Swamin Vahanse's servants. You are not the Sasana's servants. You are the master and you are the servant. You are the master and you are the servant. You are being served what you mastered. What you cooked for yourself is now being served to you. So be very aware of that and be very conscious of that, ladies and gentlemen. This is where that compass will matter. Always aware that your compass will determine where you head and where you end up. Make sure that you are always in agreement with your conscience. No, your conscience. Please make sure that you are always in agreement with your conscience. Try your best. I perhaps it will not always be easy or possible to do, right? But for your own sake, try your best to be honest to your conscience, to be authentic to your conscience, to be truthful to your conscience. When your conscience says, don't do it, don't just ignore that. There's a very good reason why your conscience is saying it should not be done. It is all the teachings that you have been given. It is every lesson that you have learned. It's all the love, affection, teaching and upbringing that your parents, your teachers and have ever given you. It's all of that together is one voice. That is your conscience. One voice speaks on behalf of everything you have learned, all the experience you've had in life, or everything you've learned about the good, bad and the ugly about life. All of that speaks at once. So don't just ignore that. Don't just take it with a pinch of salt. Heed, wherever possible, what your conscience says. See, now you know what to do and what not to do. In almost every situation in life. So you don't need to come back again to Sunday sermons. You are now free to go. So from here on, listen to your conscience. Try and live a life where when you go to bed at night, your conscience, you're not kept awake by the loud voice of your conscience. You know, you can quieten every other noise in the background, right? You can ask people in the next room to keep quiet because you're trying to sleep. You can close your windows, your shutters, your blinds, and shout out every other light and every other sound because you want to try and get some sleep. You can turn off the TV, you can turn off the radio, you can turn off the music, you can put your phone on silent. But even when the whole world is silent, pin drop silence, yet you put your head on that pillow and then you hear a voice. How do you silence that guy? Haven't you experienced this? Oh, am I the only one who's had this experience? See, when the whole world is silent, the whole world is prepared to let you sleep. Right? You worked hard and now you deserve a good night's rest. Yeah? So the whole world is prepared to let you sleep. Your children are very respectful. They're very grateful to you as their mother, as their father. They know that you're a very hard-working person, mother and father. So they want to give you rest. They want to let you sleep in peace and quiet. But there's a voice that says, how dare you? What were you thinking? How could you? Why did you? Why didn't you? She trusted you. He believed in you. You broke that trust. That was evil. That was bad. That was terrible. That was wicked. How could you do something like that? When that voice starts to mutter, you know, it's going to be a long night. Not the softest pillow in the world then. Or the most comfortable mattress in the world can get you a good night's sleep. You could be sleeping on a bed of clouds, but you would still not fall asleep. And that is all because of that conscience. You can't kill the conscience, ladies and gentlemen. You can't kill it. You've got to learn to be at peace with it. First of all, we've got to live a life where our conscience stops accusing us. See, I'm introducing you to a noble friend. That's what I'm doing here. I'm not going to come home with you unless you come home with me. Now, we can only play it one way. And if you want me, there's only one way you can have it. Come home with me. I'm not coming home with you. As several of you have done by this point. People who have decided that they want to spend the rest of their life with me. They came home with me. There's still plenty of room for many more if you want to come and join us. Actually, this morning we are opening up another Satapanavasa, another dormitory that can accommodate 400 people. This morning, it's happening right now as we speak. I think it will be done by now. A new dormitory which will house 400 monks and anagarikas at the monastery. So, plenty of room. Plenty more beds that need people to sleep on. Plenty more pillows that need people to rest their heads on. Come on. The house has been built. Because he said, build it and they shall come. We built it. Come on then. That was Noah's Ark. This is the Jetonarama Monastery. So we built it. So come two by two then. Or one by one, however you want. Lots of biblical references today. I don't know where they're coming from, but they're coming from somewhere. So be it. That's why I don't come here to listen to a Buddhist sermon. Not from this Swami Mahansi. Because I'm not Buddhist. And I'm not Christian. I'm not Muslim. I'm not Hindu. I'm not even an atheist. Religion is not something I define myself with. I am neither religious nor non-religious. Religion is not part of my definition. I just come for the truth. People dress the truth up in various guises. And they take one version of the truth and they say that is Christianity. They take another version of the truth and they say that is Islam. They take another version of the truth and they say that is Buddhism. Ultimately, what they don't know is they're all talking about the same truth. But to try and fit it into some kind of, like to shoehorn it into some kind of way that so it looks different to the others, because that's what people want, like separation. They bring in religion promising unity and harmony and peace. That's what they bring in. But they all stack it up high and sell it cheap. That's, and so we all fall into that trap. It's just misfortunate, quite unfortunate, that they take the truth and then they dress it up in religion, just so that they can now segregate the truth in many different forms, and then say, this is the one version of the, this is our version of the, this is our version of the truth. Now you have many versions of the truth and people are just confounded. They don't know which version of the truth to go for. You know, the truth is, the Buddhists are as confused as the Muslims. And they're as confused as the Christians. And they're as confused as the Hindus. They're all confused. They're all confused. Most people just follow a religion because that is the religion into which they were born. Fortunately, that choice gets made for them. For that very reason, people identify themselves with the religion. In some ways, I wonder, you know, whether that is the right thing to do. Like from religion, you know, from birth, you get mother, you get father, you get name, you get religion. I don't know. I have a different take on that. Mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, name, okay. But religion? What if the child doesn't want religion? But the child wants the truth. The problem is this. The religion is not necessarily the truth. Therefore, when people believe that religion is the truth, that's where the problem is. It's like walking up this hill. Destitute. When someone says that religion is the truth and the truth is religion, now you have a problem. Because the moment someone tells you that religion is the truth, now you stop your search for the truth, don't you? Because you are born with religion. See, when you were born, you were either born as a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Christian or something, right? Because your parents said that you were of a certain religion. And then they said that is the ultimate truth of the world, of existence, of everything. So then you stop looking for the truth because it was like a birthright. It was just there. It was there. You just have to be. If you were born a Christian, you just had to be a Christian. If you were born a Buddhist, you just had to be a Buddhist. That's all. Therefore, we stopped looking for the truth. We were discouraged to look for the truth, to search for the truth. Our search for the truth was discouraged. What I'm doing now is encouraging you to search the truth. Look for the truth. That's why I say, put religion to a side. I'm not saying discard religion. Make use of the best bits of religion. If it brings people together, good. If it encourages people to do good things, good. Good deeds, good. Meritorious deeds, good. Make religion, use religion for that purpose, the purpose for which it was invented. Religion is an invention. Can I prove that point to you, that religion is an invention? Where was Buddhism before the Buddha? But what about the Four Noble Truths? That was always there. Only no one spoke of it. But Buddhism as a religion, that came into being after the Buddha. So then it was invented. If something's invented, it is not an absolute truth. Because truths need no inventor. Who invented physics? No one invented physics. But they invented the telescope. They invented the microscope. They invented the oscilloscope. But they didn't invent physics. Physics was always there because that's the truth. In the same way, the Four Noble Truths, the truths about this world, give and get. What you give is what you get. These are timeless truths. They need no inventor. Where was Christianity before Jesus? Where is Islam before the Prophet? That's the thing. Those were inventions. We don't necessarily have to discard inventions. We make use of inventions for a particular purpose. But don't let your religious affiliation, your identification as a religion, of to whatever religion that was given to you, perhaps by your parents, don't let that deter you from your search for the truth. Because religion is one, the truth is another. If you are religious, perhaps it will guide you towards the truth. Maybe it will create an environment for you towards the truth. It will help you be a good man, a good woman, a good person. Remember, goodness is the foundation to greatness. But because it's an invention, people can put in all sorts of stuff into a religion. I mean, tomorrow they can invent another religion. Tomorrow they could invent another religion and then say, in this religion, to go to heaven, you must kill. Ah, thank you. Not love thy neighbor, kill thy neighbor. Then they'll say that's an ideology. Do that and that is the path to heaven. They'll say that is the path to the truth. Don't take that word. The truth does not come dressed in religion. No, if you want to find the truth, first listen to your conscience. If you lack a noble friend to get advice from, to get guidance from, to take instruction from, use the one that you already have. Yes. The one whose voice always speaks up to you and speaks to you. Listen to that voice. Then, do as your conscience says. Not do as the book says. That's not what I suggest. Not do as the book says. Not do as the TV says. Not do as your friends say. Not even do as your parents say. Do as your conscience says. Do as your conscience says. Do as your conscience says and always do what your conscience says is right to do. Morally right. And then, what happens then is this. Every time you do what your conscience says is right, is the right thing to do, you please God for the God believers and you please goodness for those who believe in karma and vipaka. Good karma is generated. And that good karma will eventually bring you a noble friend. See, that's where you start. That good karma will bring to you a noble friend. And then that noble friend shall guide you to calibrate your compass further so that you can then step from goodness to greatness. Now do you see the whole picture? So then, must a man have a religion to be a good human being? No, because you were born with what? With conscience. You are born with conscience. A little bit of God in each and every one of you. We were all born with a little bit of goodness in each and every one of us. That goodness will always guide you, ladies and gentlemen. But people will start filling your heads with all sorts of things. Don't try to mute the sound of your or the voice of your conscience with other things you have learned and the voices of your friends and your families and other things. Don't try to mute it with that. Check whether what you've heard, what you've learned, agrees with your conscience. If it doesn't agree with your conscience, go back to the person who said you and asked you to do something and check with them. You tell them, Mother, you've asked me to do something, but my conscience doesn't agree with that. What must I do? Can you help me make sense of that, please? I know that you would never ask me to do something that is wrong. But my conscience doesn't agree with that. Please can you tell me where we are, where I'm not seeing eye to eye? Where have I missed the bigger picture? Go to your father, go to your mother, go to your teacher, go to them and ask. Go to your friend and ask. Just because they say so doesn't mean you should do it. Just because I say you should do something doesn't mean you should do it if it does not agree with your conscience, ladies and gentlemen. Because I don't come home with you, your conscience does. My voice you can silence. Your conscience you can't. I won't wake you up when you try to fall asleep. Your conscience will. I won't trouble you when you try to meditate. Your conscience will. You try sitting down and try Arya Maitri, and your conscience will say, what Arya Maitri man? You're always hurting other people's feelings. You're not kind to your family. You're not kind to your wife. You're not kind to your children. You're so evil at the workplace. Always bossing people around and talking down to them. What Arya Maitri? That's what your conscience will say. What will Swaminarayan say? Sit down. Take a deep breath. May I and all beings in all worlds. That's all I can do. I won't bother you. Soon after you close your eyes and you appear to be in a deep state of meditation, I will just keep quiet and walk away. I won't bother you, but your conscience will. That's why. Don't do something just because I ask you to do it. Check with your conscience. If your conscience doesn't agree, come and ask. I don't mean your existing set of knowledge. I mean your conscience. They're two different things. Knowledge you have to acquire. A good conscience you're born with. Right from an early age where you start to understand how the world works, right? You have this internal sense of, I don't want to do others what I don't want others to do to me. That is your most basic sense of a good conscience. We are all born with that. You can't deny that. We are all born with that. I don't wish to, and it's wrong to do to others what I don't want others to do to me. We are all born with that. That you don't need to learn at school. You may learn it at school, but you don't have to go to school to learn that. You're born with that. Start from that. Start there. Start there and listen to that voice. And do what that voice says. And then as you do what that voice says, you will start earning merits. Remember, it's not the actions, but the intentions behind the actions that becomes your merit. And that merit then begins to grow. That cultivates. And it brings you a noble friend one day. First, it will bring you good friends. Because you are being good. When you are being good, ladies and gentlemen, you will be surrounded by good people. People who think like you. People who want to be like you. People who want to be the same thing you want to be. They will start spending time with you. And then you will be given that association. You will receive that association. That will further foster your way of thinking. It will nurture your thoughts. Then you will start picking up good habits. See, this is a life plan for you. This should not be given for free, by the way. We should start charging you for tickets. And then, more merits you do, the more good people you end up being surrounded by. And then one day those merits will culminate into bringing a noble friend into your presence. And then that friend will teach you how to now calibrate your compass from goodness to greatness. You can't make that jump without the association of a noble friend. No matter how good you are, no matter how good you are, once again, no matter how good you are, you cannot make that jump. Mother Teresa cannot become a sotapanna unless she associates at least a sotapanna. She might be a mother to the whole world, but she cannot become an Aryan unless she associates with one. But the whole world sees her as a mother. But that's the best she can be. But she must have lived a very good life. Therefore laid down a great foundation of goodness. And that foundation would have grown, would have cultivated. Perhaps today she's in the association of noble ones. Who knows? Maybe That's one of you. Or maybe she must have become an arahatteri and maybe already passed away into parinibbana. Who knows? So much goodness was done in her life. But being good alone does not become one to become help one to become an arahant. You have to have that association. But that association, the power that is required for that association, the essence, the juice that is needed for that association, you must generate by being good. So what does goodness take? How much does it cost? How much does goodness cost? Is it a life, is it an arm or limb? What must you give up? No. It's only the intention behind your actions. It's never the size. It's always the sentiment. Why you do something is what matters. What you do matters to the other person. Why you do matters to you. See, that's a good philosophy. Another good philosophy to remember. What you do matters to the other person. You could be the kindest person in the world, but if you slap someone in the face, does it not hurt them nonetheless? See, what you do matters to the other person. But why you do it matters to you. So, we have a responsibility to two people in this world. Two people. One is to you and the other is to the person in front of you. So to both these individuals we have a responsibility. Therefore, you must watch out and always do the right thing. Do the right thing. So the what is also important, but the why is also just as important. Doing a good what means people around you will benefit. Having a good why means you shall benefit. Right, time for today. Before I conclude, you know that we've been doing a lot with languages, and we are also, of course, working together on the International Language Center, which we fondly refer to as Little Britain. So that project is getting close to a point where we can lay the foundation stone. I think by January, the start of the dawn of the new year, we should be there. Guru Hanra is going to be going out to Australia and New Zealand for a few weeks. So I think when he's back, it'll be a good time for us to initiate that project, something we've all been waiting for and longing for. Because you know that what you have, you got because you gave. You've given in the past, and therefore there's only one way to get, and that is to give. So that is an opportunity for us all to get together and give. But before that event, on the 30th of November, which is the end of last Sunday of this month, we have a little function at the monastery. It is called the Global Language Initiative for Inner Peace. We have been learning many languages over the last few months and last few years, actually. Many Swamin Mahanses, many Anagarikas. Anagarika Mahatas, they also start, but they actually pick up their practice once they come into robes, because there are plenty of other things that they need to be getting on with during the Anagarika period, like bringing us here, looking after us. You know, when you are there, they are the ones who run around like ants all over the place, right? Making sure that you're comfortable, attending to you, attending to the Swami Nuhanses, carrying the Motukuda, laying down the carpets, setting out the Dhamma hall. So there's a lot of work that they're already doing. We didn't want to put another burden of learning languages. But as the Pandu program starts, which is the last 2 months before ordination, they start picking up a new language. And then they commit themselves publicly, which is what you hear when they give their commitment in the video on the day of the ordination. So we have been learning several languages over the last few years. So it has come to a point where we now have 25 languages that we are all learning together as a family, as a monastery, which is, in my opinion, quite quite a number. To me, what that means is, it's like having 25 different passports. So you can have passports for the sasana. Because we reach people by speaking to their hearts. If you speak to a man in a language he understands, that's good, you can make sense. But if you speak to a man in his mother language, in his mother tongue, in his own language, then you can speak to his heart. And that's where the transformation begins to occur. So we believe in that, and therefore we have been investing time and our energy. We meaning who? All of us. Who's given us the books? Who's given us the teachers? Who's given us the technology? Who's given us the classrooms? Who's given us the stationery? Like I said, I only have the two robes and my arms bow. Everything else comes from our devoted devotees who love the sasana just as much as we do. It is people who believe in the purpose of why we do this. That vision. I think that is where we are all united. The vision that we all have. Oftentimes I have said, don't offer to me. Offer to what I stand for. Offer to the cause of what I am here to achieve. So that is what we have all been doing. And so on the 30th of November, we will be launching 25 YouTube channels. Each of these channels will be in a different language and will carry the message that brings inner peace. Let's not call it Buddhism. Let's not call it Buddhism. Let's call it the message that brings people inner peace. We'll be sharing that message to all corners of the world. We don't know how long it'll take for those channels to pick up, whether we'll have any viewers at all. At least the person posting will go and check whether it's live on the channel. But over time, people will pick up. Then they get to hear that this initiative is up and running. When people have enough merits and they want the truth, like I explained to you just a moment ago, build on that foundation of goodness and a noble friend appears. What is the saying? When the who is ready, does the what appear? When the teachers, come on. When the student is ready, the teacher appears, of course. So when they are ready, the teacher shall appear. So one of these days, they will be just scrolling on the internet, browsing on YouTube, and then they will randomly just run into one of these sermons. And maybe that will be in Polish. So they click on that, and then they, for the first time in their entire life, they hear, wow, where did that come from? So then they will subscribe to the channel. One viewer. That's enough. If through all this we can produce one arahant, that's one arahant more than we have right now, isn't it? So be it then. So that is what we are going to be doing on the 30th. We are going to be launching all those 25 YouTube channels. And I can't say I want, because then you will have to bend over backwards to do that. I would like for all of you to be there, if you can. So Sunday, this is a Sunday, so therefore we don't have this sermon in the morning. But the morning's function will conclude just before arms round. And then after that we have the afternoon session. And we can have the sermon, an afternoon sermon on that day. But if you can be there in the morning, it would be a fantastic opportunity for all of us to be part of that. And we have invited some dignitaries from... When we picked these dignitaries, we've tried to find people who can take this message out to the rest of the world. So on some occasions, we have tried to engage with embassies. What we are looking for is not authority or power. What we are looking for is contact. To build bridges, because you need the bridge to take the message. So if they know people in those countries to whom they can just pass a word, that's where we have been trying to target this. But not everyone will be from embassies. We'll have average people like you and me as well. Sorry, me, not you. You're special. But you're all very much welcome. And I invite you all to give up some time next Sunday if you can. be there to witness that fantastic launching event of those channels and give your blessings, share your blessings. Want it to be successful. The same thing I said with Little Britain. Not asking for what's in your pocket. I'm asking for what's in your heart. I know you want these things to be successful. That's what I want. Want it to be successful. Because when you make a wish, ladies and gentlemen, you're not just any other person. You're a person who has a noble purpose, a noble ambition. Therefore, when you make a determination, the chances of that coming true are greater. So that's what we want for the whole world. So the invitation is there then, the 30th of November morning. If you can get there by, the function starts at 8. So if you can get there slightly before that, then we can settle you down and prepare for the event. It'll go on just until the arms round. And then we'll finish at that point. We'll give you a break and then we'll have a session in the afternoon for all of our English listeners. A sermon will be held at the monastery. Do you have the video? Okay, so I have a short video just about the event. Did you notice that there was also a silent language? Just think about the kindness, the goodness that must be there in those hearts. The want, the desire to take this message even to people who can't hear what we say. That's why I say, you know, I have such a good fortune, the good fortune to live among wonderful people. And that's all of you, that's all of us, that's all of them. We have a team of monks and anagarikas who are learning the sign language. They're learning how to express anicca, dukkha, anatta. The timeless wisdom taught by the great philosophers, the great teachers we have seen, that humanity has ever seen. Usually you find people learning this language if you're either a teacher to students who are hard of hearing or deaf, and to individuals who are deaf or who are born deaf. Usually that's when you find this people learning that language. But here, it's not for them. It's not for them. One of our Swaminas is learning Arabic. We don't know how successful it will be, but that's not going to stop us from trying. We will try. Because it's not what you do. It's why. So if the what we do turns out to be unsuccessful, so what? The why is never unsuccessful, is it? The why is never unsuccessful. The why is always successful. For good or bad, it's always successful. The what might work out, might not work out. It's okay. German, Polish, French, Spanish, Italian, just a few that come to mind, Arabic, sign language, Pali, Sanskrit, Sinhalese and English, of course, you know. Then there's Swahili. We are very fortunate to have a few gentlemen from Kenya. Swahili is their mother tongue. And they're happy to share what they have learned from their teachers. Swedish. Just to name a few. Telugu, Malayalam, Hindi. I'm sure I must have missed a few. Too many to remember now. See, this is what God put us on this earth for. To love, to care, to be kind, to help. Be part of that mission, ladies and gentlemen. Be part of that mission. Be part of that mission. Create space for God in your heart. God in your heart is the same as good in your heart. Make a heaven out of earth. There are too many people trying to make hell out of earth. We can't expect them to stop. But we can make heaven out of earth. So let's do that. Right, let's do the merit transfer and conclude for today. First and foremost, let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and listen to the Dhamma and practice the Dhamma diligently. Let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the Mahanayakas, the Anunayakas, as well as all the monks of all of the chapters throughout the world who sacrificed their lives to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by translating their talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. Let us also transfer this message to our devotees, friends of the monastery, who for the sake of their own Nibbana continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in this merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, as well as anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities, Devas, Brahmas, reminding ourselves that they have done what they can to preserve the Sambuddha Sasana, and they watch out for you to ensure your safety and well-being. Let us transfer these merits also to our forefathers, our ancestors, those who passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us transfer these merits also to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe. Let us transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends to us. Therefore, with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness towards all of them, let us transfer these merits to all. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they redeem themselves to be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Theranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnan midatnva dvesha ginnan Nidatnva Moha Ginnan Nidatnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan
sukhita taravatma nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravatma nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravatma raga gini niveva dvesha gini niveva moha gini niveva nivansata ladeva nivansata ladeva nivansata ladeva තුන්රුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්ත්වයන් නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.